and you are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and online at kpfa.org. My name is C.S. Song. Genius, megalomania, madness, and rollicking humor. That's what's on offer at the Berklee Repertory Theater because Mike Daisy is back in town performing a series of monologues entitled Great Men of Genius in four shows, which you can see individually or in an all-day marathon. Mike Daisy profiles the lives of four legendary figures, P.T. Barnum, Bertolt Brecht, L. Ron Hubbard, and Nikola Tesla. In the process, Daisy offers more than a few hilarious insights into his own personal life, drawing intriguing parallels and asking questions about human nature, unnatural obsession, and the extremes to which some of us, maybe all of us, will go. Mike Daisy is an author, commentator, and monologist. His one-man shows include 21 Dog Years, Invincible Summer, and The Ugly American, and his monologue, which I've heard also called a bialogue, Great Men of Genius, plays at Berklee Repertory Theater through July 1st. Mike joins me in our Berklee studios. Welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
Give the listeners who haven't seen Great Men of Genius a sense of what it's all about. The lights come up, you're sitting at a table, you have a sip of water, and then what?
And then I begin speaking. Generally, it's a it's extemporaneous storytelling. So what I do is I perform seated at that table with an outline that tells me that I've crafted, that gives me a sense of the places I'm going to go in the narrative. And then I turn the pages of the outline and I tell the story of the life of whatever genius it is that I'm speaking about in that monologue from birth to death. And I weave against the biographical information, autobiographical stories from my own life that I think either relate to or rub against the conflicts that I'm trying to illuminate in this particular pass through someone's life. Because any story, you know, you can't tell all of someone's life in a story. So it's a very conscious effort to sort of craft monologues that reflect sort of essential conflicts within the lives of these people, and then use that as a mirror for looking at ourselves.
How did you go about choosing the four men profiled in Great Men of Genius?
It was a long time coming. I'm very prolific. I make a lot of monologues, and they grow in the back of my mind over time. And I knew for a very long time that I wanted to do pieces about each of these four men, like for many, many years. And in each case, I would know that I wanted to speak about Bertolt Brecht. I'd always been fascinated by Brecht for years, for instance. But my pieces generally are multiple strands woven against each other, and I never knew what the other strands were. And so it would always sort of wait in the back of my mind. And the real synthesis moment was when I realized that I needed to put all four of them together, that what I really wanted to talk about was the connective tissue that makes me obsessed and interested with each of these four very different men, and an effort to take four very different people, all of whom, however, I believe have great gifts, and sort of weave them against each other and pull them into a narrative that might illuminate something about being human.
What kinds of questions do you like to raise about genius and what it is and how it comes to be?
Well, I'm very interested in the idea of genius, whether it's fundamental to the human condition or a societal construct. Like, it seems to me that genius, when we use that term, only exists through the work of groups. Like, you need a group to declare someone a genius. I mean, people can self-declare themselves geniuses, but generally that results in them being branded as megalomaniacs. Of course, the bizarre thing is that each of the four geniuses that I profile are all prone to megalomania in one form or another. And I think that an argument can be made, and I make it through the pieces, that obsession and megalomania are actually integral to genius, because what is genius if not the act of the human reaching beyond the human, you know, doing things that literally people could not have imagined were possible for good or for evil. And those creations that reach beyond us, you have to be a megalomaniac on some level to imagine doing things that are not traditionally humanly possible. And so that's the reason, that's sort of the reason for the examination, is to pull them all next to each other. And instead of writing a book or like an academic document, the form of the monologue is a live emotional story. So it's an effort to sort of take a path through these men's lives and use them not so much to see, you know, why did they do what they did, but to make it become a mirror and a doorway that we can walk through and look at why we make the decisions we do in our own lives.
Mike Daisy joins us in our Berkeley studios. He is a contributing writer to Wired, Slate, and Salon. He's also an author, a filmmaker, and commentator. And his monologues include a number of highly acclaimed shows, including Truth and The Ugly American and 21 Dog Years about his stint at Amazon.com. He's currently performing a series, a four-part series of monologues at Berkeley Rep entitled Great Men of Genius, runs through July 1st at Berkeley Repertory Theater. We have a link to that show and to ticket information on our website, againstthegrain.org. Your past monologues have been largely autobiographical, and I wonder if you decided you need to do something special in order to change, in order to talk, you know, to a large extent, to a significant extent, not to an exclusive extent in these monologues, but about other people.
Certainly, my first monologues were largely or entirely autobiographical. It's been changing gradually for quite some time. The pieces I've been able to bring to the Bay Area have all been primarily autobiographical. But starting a few years ago, even before Great Men of Genius began to coalesce, I started working in, I always think of it as the biographical rather than the autobiographical, because I'm still interested in life stories because they're just not always necessarily my own. And I'm not interested in the form of becoming, you know, other people. But I am very interested in perspective and being able to talk about illustrating moments from other people's lives or things and then seeing them juxtaposed with my own life. I feel like it enriches the experience, not to mention that it feels true to my experience of human existence. Like, I go through life, not the sharpest stick in the drawer, but I do, you know, I read a lot and I watch things and I think about what I do on my, you know, on my time off when I'm not on stage, and I engage with the world. And so I feel like if the form of the monologue for me is to continue to be engaging and successful, it needs to grow. You know, it needs to grow and find new boundaries. And I became dissatisfied with the sort of exclusively autobiographical mode that I think personal monologue had kind of trended toward. And I practiced it myself. It can be very valuable. But the world is larger than one person's mind. And by drawing in other things, the things I actually think about, it allows you to sort of bounce back and forth between the public and the private. And I feel like it broadens the canvas. And a lot of this project to create what is actually, you know, it's in four parts, but is a five-hour monologue, is an effort to create a larger canvas for creating this kind of work, something epic. Something that I think these megalomaniacal geniuses might have appreciated if they were around still.
Your autobiographical vignettes are often hilarious. And I just wonder, because there are so many funny stories you tell about your childhood and your adolescence and even just, you know, yourself as an adult. Did you think of your life as funny while you were enacting it?
Well, I think that I think that the process of humor is really mysterious. I do think that most humor springs from misery. And generally, when I was undergoing miserable experiences, I was miserable, generally without exclusion. And it's retrospect. You know, it's the power of storytelling, I think, that allows us to contextualize things that are miserable that happened to us and look back on them and say, like, that was extremely funny because it was extremely miserable. And that's definitely true in my life. And I actually try to keep that as a rule. Like, I found that if I am doing something and I begin thinking, oh, this will make a really good story, it tends to make the moment mannered. Like, it takes some effort and some discipline, but I really try to, like, be like, I am living my life right now. My job as a monologuist is to be a chronicler of my life in retrospect. Now, the retrospect, it may have been just a week ago, but my job when I'm speaking to the audience is to speak about my life at that moment, live on stage. And therefore, when I'm living my life, try at least to live it fully and completely in the moment and not thinking endlessly about what would make a good story. Because real life, real unmediated life, is always so much more interesting than what we can cobble together with our fictions and our premeditation. So I try at least not to do that.
Yeah, it really surprised me to some degree that your shows are almost entirely extemporaneous. As you said, you have this sort of skeleton outline on the table while you're performing, but you rarely look at it. And as you said, it really has only the broadest outlines of what you want to cover.
Mm-hmm.
What's behind that? Because, well, part of it is when you talk on stage, it sounds like you've rehearsed it. It sounds so, it just comes out of your mouth in such a flowing way. So that's one thing which made me think, well, Mike has figured this all out in advance. And second of all, do you have certain anxieties about forgetting something or saying something awkwardly in front of all these people?
Oh, yes. I have lots of anxieties about that. And not only do I have anxieties, I do it. I do it all the time in front of people. I say things awkwardly in performance. I say things backwards. I'll invert logic. The oral patterning is very interesting. Like, if you looked at a transcript even of what I'm saying in this conversation, you know, the punctuation, the rhythms of it would be very strange looking, you know. And it's amazing what the human ear will accept. Like, I'll say something backwards and realize I just said the opposite of what I was supposed to say.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't go backwards. You can't go backwards in a live performance. You can't go backwards in life either. So I just keep rolling forward, and I count a lot on intention. If your intention is pure, that doesn't mean virginal, but it just means if you're really certain of what it is you're trying to communicate with your whole self, even if you use the wrong words, the audience will feel that they understand you because you are pushing the meaning through the words themselves, and they can actually see it sort of written in the air in front of them. I work extemporaneously because I value the live experience. I think there is something incredibly pluralistic about telling stories on stage that are truly live, that are not scripted in any way, because every human being can tell stories. And there's something very exciting for me about coming into what is traditionally sort of a hallowed space, you know, the Berkeley Repertory Theater, a theater, and always they're always like churches, and they're my churches, and I love them for that. And the people come and sit in these seats, which are little like pews, and we all have this moment of communion where we talk. But I think it's so important to make it a common, full, and complete experience, to make it a kind of art that every person walking in the street, if you stop them, no matter who they were, whether they'd ever even thought about going to the theater, you said, there's a guy and he tells stories. He sits on stage and he tells stories. I think everyone would understand that. And so for me, that's sort of a vital piece of why I'm excited about this kind of performance.
I have some storyteller friends who tell me that storytelling is a dying art.
Really?
Yeah, that, you know, storytelling festivals, and it's just hard to keep them going, and less people, well, more and more people are drawn to other forms of media, that it's a hard go. You don't find that at all?
Well, that's the thing about storytelling, is that it's such a primal form that it's been co-opted into every other art form. So, I mean, you can argue that it's dying, but at the same time, I mean, storytelling is, what is storytelling? It is narrative. It's the process of human consciousness made real. So, I mean, all of our television, all of our movies, everything practically that we do is predicated on narrative construction that comes out of storytelling. When when families gather together, when friends meet, what do? Oh, they may drink, they might go out for dinner. What they really do is tell stories to one another. My experience is that the form is fine. The form, I think, is actually doing very, very well. There are organizations in New York, certainly, and regionally, The Moth and Speakeasy and these other ones that are growing nationally along the East Coast and trying to reach out to the West that try to foster the kind of storytelling for audiences. But storytelling itself, the process, is so much larger than any one of us that it's in no danger. I totally believe that storytelling festivals might have problems because it's hard to organize live events that galvanize people and make them want to leave where they are. And it's very common in the theater to blame this on, like, oh, people with their iPods and their websites, they don't want to do anything. But I think that's shirking our duties as artists. Like, if people don't want to go, if people aren't feeling like what they see live is better than what they see on their television, we need to step our game up. Mm-hmm. We need to bring things that compel them to go because they want to be delighted. They want to be taken out of themselves and changed. The truth is that television is a remarkable and interesting and fascinating medium, and you have 1,000 channels on your television, but no matter what you click on that television, it is still an image in a screen, in a box, sitting in your den. You know, it's not actually live in front of you. And if you can find ways to exploit that liveness, it's like nothing else on earth. So, I mean, I'm sort of conflicted. It's like, you know, storytelling is in trouble in that I do wish there were more people telling stories on stage live without scripts. But at the same time, it's so universal. The tools are all there. I mean, the work I'm doing is I make references to America's Next Top Model and things that are happening right now. But at the same time, I'm very aware that the form goes all the way back to the Greeks and beyond the Greeks, you know, back into our prehistory. And so I know very well that no matter what happens, the tools will still be sitting there in the human consciousness long after I'm gone.
Mike Daisy, master storyteller, monologuist. I'm learning how to pronounce that word. He wears many other hats. He joins us in studio on Against the Grain. Associate producer Jen Angel is at the controls. My name is C.S. Song. On our website, againstthegrain.org, we have a link to information about Mike Daisy's current show, kind of a series of 4 shows, although you can see them all together like I did on a Sunday at Berkeley Repertory Theater. It's entitled Great Men of Genius. He profiles the lives of P.T. Barnum, Bertolt Brecht, L. Ron Hubbard, and Nikola Tesla. Quite a combination. If you want to call for information or tickets, you can call 510-647-2949, 510-647-2949. We also have a link on againstthegrain.org to Mike Daisy's personal website. You can read his blog and read about his very interesting and idiosyncratic and to some degree universal thoughts. Let's talk about at least one of the people you profile, Bertolt Brecht. Now, you say in this monologue that you got really interested in him very quickly, I think in college, took some classes, and you tell this hilarious story about performing in something that featured his work and his theory. It was a lot of theory in there. In what ways did Brecht try and shake up what theater meant and what audiences might do in response to what they saw on stage?
Well, Brecht was very interested in the idea that theater should be a live medium instead of a dead one. And he defined death in the theater as being emotionally, basically emotionally invested in what's happening in stage, emotionally invested to the point where thinking is no longer possible. He believed that the act of believing what you were seeing on stage completely and fully kept you from thinking, really thinking about the issues that art should be raising. He liked to say that art is not a mirror held up to the face of reality. It is a hammer with which to shape it. And he really believed that art could change the world. And I was 18, and I found this incredibly moving. It really fired me up a lot. And it's informed my work since then in a lot of ways. And a lot of the monologue sort of wrestles with the passage from youth to adulthood in my life and the process of compromise. Like, I think that monologue is a lot about idealism versus compromise and sort of going back and forth between the two.
And Brecht had chances to compromise his own vision. One of them was in front of the House Un-American Activities Committee.
Right.
He was a very political figure, a socialist.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of appearance did he make before HUAC?
Well, he testified. He didn't refuse to testify, which he had led others to believe that he would do. And then he changed course when he was in the room in front of the committee, which was very Brecht. He's always a survivor, very much the survivor, always, because he fled Nazi Germany and fled through Europe and fled, slowly putting on resistance plays and being hunted by the Nazis, and then came to America and ended up in Hollywood, of all places, as a hack screenwriter. a tremendous story of survival. And, part of the process of survival is that we're always excited that the people survived, but, actions have to be taken in order for people to survive, for art to survive. And I think that was the struggle of Brecht's life was, I think he constantly had to compromise, and he was an incredibly idealistic person, but he was willing to make very hard choices and then live with the consequences of them. And so ultimately he fled America. Right after he testified, he took the money that had been allocated to purchase a lawyer and instead used it to buy a ticket to Switzerland and flew away before finishing his testimony and never returned to America for the rest of his life. And his friends and colleagues felt very betrayed that he wouldn't stand with them and not testify. Many of them served jail time, for not testifying. And he never apologized. He never shirked that he'd done it, but he also never apologized, which was also very much in his character.
Nikola Tesla did some pioneering work in the field of electricity and magnetism, and you reflect in your piece about why we don't think of Tesla as a household word the same way we do, say, Edison. And one thing that's interesting about this piece is the way he descends later in life, and people start to think he's gone mad. Could you talk a little bit about that? And also, what's this death ray that he claims to have come up with?
Well, Tesla is fascinating. His form of electricity is the electricity we all use every day. He had a large war with Thomas Edison over the standards for electricity, and a war which Nikola Tesla ultimately won. Unfortunately, Tesla didn't align himself with the correct corporate interests, and basically he had his ideas sold out from under him, which is the reason that he didn't become one of the richest men in America. And I think if he had become one of the richest men in America, we'd all know his name, because often if you're rich, mm-hmm. We remember your name very, very well because you have a corporation associated with that name. And so despite having made some of the most revolutionary discoveries and really being the inventor of the 20th century, he's largely forgotten today. And a large part of that is also due to the fact that as he got older, he became more and more erratic. Erratic in that he would have brilliant ideas that would completely pan out, and then the next idea he would talk about would appear to be insane. But because he was so brilliant and had basically invented the radio and all these huge things, no one could tell which ideas were crazy and which ideas were totally valid but sounded crazy. And so he did, in fact, announce to the world that he had constructed a death ray, which I think in many ways helps cement him as sort of the living embodiment of the archetype of the mad scientist, because who else invents a death ray and calls it a death ray and then calls a press conference to show everyone his death ray except a mad scientist?
P.T. Barnum, we only really have time to touch on a few of these characters. And obviously, if you want to see, I think each monologue is about 75 minutes
yes.
long. And you can see them individually. I guess Wednesday, every Wednesday is Brecht. And it mm-hmm. keeps going Thursday, Friday, Saturday. And Sundays, you can see all four profiles in a row with a break for dinner. P.T. Barnum, Bertolt Brecht, L. Ron Hubbard, Nikola Tesla, Mike Daisy performing Great Men of Genius at Berklee Repertory Theater. P.T. Barnum, the circus magnate, his big thing, or the theme that you like to focus on in your piece, is this question of appealing to the high and the low,
yes,
the sacred and the profane. In what ways did Barnum do that kind of thing?
Well, you can argue that he was the progenitor of what we think of today as sort of pop culture, progenitor of the idea of that there are things that everyone should be talking about. He was very good at sort of mining from the newspapers ideas that were floating in the air and then concretizing them into events, spectacles that people had to see to be part of the conversation. Like one of the freaks in his employ was Zip the Pinhead. And Zip the Pinhead, his claim to fame is that he has a very tiny head and a very large body. It's actually, you know, that's it. That's the whole thing. He has a tiny head and a large body. It's not really that much to look at.
Mm-hmm.
But he had the idea that since everyone was up in arms about evolution at that time, and you can argue they're still up in arms about evolution today, so things may not have changed as much as they would appear.
Mm.
They're up in arms about evolution. So he created an exhibit called What Is It? And really, it posited that Zip the Pinhead was this missing link in the process of evolution, which even a cursory examination in that era, is sort of like, no, it was obviously not a missing. I mean, like, this is ridiculous. But he was very good at picking things that it became vital, even if you disagreed, even if you knew it was ridiculous. Everyone felt that they had to see it in order to participate in the discussion, you know? Like, you have to go see it, especially in that age without television, without any way to – you have to physically go there and see it so then you can say, no, this is not a product of evolution. This is not the missing link. And he was really good at pinpointing those sort of things and really putting his finger on the pulse of that.
How did you get into solo performance?
Well, I grew up in Maine, and there are a lot of storytellers there. And the nature of the state, there's something about the environment, the cold, desolate, and environment, honestly, that sort of lends itself to storytelling, sort of New England tradition. And I think also I grew up doing a lot of speech and debate in my high school years, and mostly revolves around extemporaneous speaking, you know, speaking in front of crowds off the cuff, as it were, after preparing some notes and sort of thinking about what you're going to say and practicing holding ideas. And throughout college, I studied a lot of theater and a lot of writing. And so in many ways, as a young artist, I've been a monologuist now for 10 years, when I was looking for a form that would give me a voice that most reflected the way in which I wanted to reach out and connect with audiences and with people, this form was the one that spoke to me the strongest.
And Mike, after your Great Men of Genius finishes up on July 1st at Berklee Repertory Theater. More information on our website, againstthegrain.org. You will do a one-time workshopping of a new show on July 3rd at Berklee Rep. It's called Tongues Will Wag. Can you give us a hint of what it's about?
Sure. Tongues Will Wag is about dogs. It's about humans and dogs. It's about dogs as pets. It's about our relationship with dogs, and specifically about that line between dogs and babies and how many dogs act as sort of surrogate babies. And personally, it's about my wife and I and our 5-year quest to get a dog and how we actually now, you know, have a dog and life with this particular dog, and how the dog very consciously has the role of being the surrogate baby in our house, because I think it's an interesting continuum how people feel about dogs. It's sort of like almost everyone agrees that we should be able to cuddle a dog. You know, it's like, oh, that's
sure.
cute.
Yeah.
And some people think cuddling a dog is great, but dog birthday parties are creepy. And then other people are sort of like, dog birthday parties are okay, but breastfeeding a dog, that's going over the line. And so I'm really interested in like where those taboos lie. So one strand of the show is about that. And the other thread, the darker thread of the show, is about my wife and I had an unexpected pregnancy a few years ago. And we decided to have an abortion. And it's about that decision and how it blew through our lives. And it changed both of us and our relationship forever, because previously we had said yes to everything in life. We sort of confronted life head on. This was really the first time that we said no. And so the show is about that, about the process of choice, really about family planning and like how do you construct a family and what are our responsibilities?
It's an eight-hour show.
It is not an eight-hour show.
There's a lot to talk about, though.
There is, but it does bear noting, since we're talking about here, it is only 90 minutes.
Tongues will wag on July 3rd, but you may want to check out Great Men of Genius by Mike Daisy, running through July 1st at Berklee Repertory Theater, 510-647-2949, 510-647-2949, resources on againstthegrain.org. Mike, thank you for the show, which I really enjoyed, and good luck, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
We'll take a short music break, and then we will be back to talk...